We're very thankful to be together this afternoon, and I'm glad for each of you who are with us. If you consider yourself of Israel, I want to join with the others in welcoming you. Hope you'll be able to join us again very soon, very often. As Brother Darrell has said, we're continuing our studies in the prophets. And my last turn up on a Sunday night, we did the first four chapters of the book of Micah. And this afternoon, it's my intention to finish the book of Micah, the last three chapters. You might recall from our earlier study, if you were with us, that Micah prophesied at a time congruent with the prophet Isaiah, developed some of the same themes that Isaiah did, just not in as much detail. Of course, Micah's book is much shorter than Isaiah. He affords us a thorough explanation of his time and the historical circumstance of his writing in Micah 1 and verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Micah the Morashthite in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Well, you can look on the chart there showing the times of the kings, and Micah makes it easy for us. Whatever timeline we contrive for his life, it needs to touch the reign of all those three kings. So that gives us a pretty firm idea of when his time of prophesying would have been. And with that, we can turn to the Kings and the Chronicles and discern the historical circumstances. And I'll refresh you on that just now. The kingdom of Israel had split, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. In the south, you had two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. In the north, you had the other 10 tribes. The northern kingdom retained the name Israel. The southern kingdom kept the name of its dominant kingly tribe, Judah. Israel's kings were all idolatrous to one degree or another. There was really, in the whole mix of them, there's maybe one you could find that was halfway decent. The rest of them were just pagans of one degree or another. And they led Israel deeper and deeper into idolatry. Judah's kings were sometimes good and sometimes bad. Some of them were very good, very godly men, and some of them were just as wicked as the kings of Israel, if not more so. And so Judah was on a roller coaster of in and out of idolatry. Because of Israel's sin and idolatry, their time as a kingdom was about to draw to an end. King Hezekiah's day saw this come about. He saw the Assyrian armies come in and destroy Israel, the northern tribes, and carry them away captive. And he feared for his own kingdom, but God spared Judah, because during Hezekiah's time, Judah was still loyal to God. However, their day was coming, because they had been in and out of this idolatrous habit and would soon after Hezekiah's time become much, much worse. It was only a matter of time before they became wicked enough that God would also allow them to be destroyed. And since Micah prophesies at a time in Israel's history that was very, very pivotal towards all these events taking place, it shouldn't surprise us to find in his book the reverberating theme of God's judgment against his sinful people, of them being destroyed and carried away captive, of the enemy nations against Israel that were also pagan, ultimately being destroyed for their wickedness. And amidst the melee of man's sin and God's judgment was a perpetually quivering, reverberating hope of a coming Messiah who would offer to man a better way. He wouldn't force it upon us, but he would make it possible. And so Micah weaves together the themes of God's judgment against sin, his awful wrath against sin, and man's stubborn perpetuation of his sinful ways, intermingled with this beautiful golden thread of hope. A thread that speaks of God's mercy and God's love, God's capacity to forgive and his desire to forgive. These are things that we find at the end of Micah's pen. I invite you to join me now in a consideration of matters in chapter 5.
We'll begin with an expectation of Christ that we find in Micah 5, verse 1 through 4. We won't look at all those verses right away. We'll look at a couple and find some other verses to bring to bear on it and then finish that section of verses. Now gather yourself in troops, O daughter of troops. He has laid siege against us. They will strike the judge of Israel with a rod on the cheek. But you, Bethlehem, Ephrata, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. This passage brings to our minds the familiar prophecy regarding Christ and his birthplace, that he was to be born in Bethlehem, in earlier times known as Ephrata. But he tells us more than that. He speaks of the judge of Israel being stricken or being hit. What is that about? Well, there's a couple lines of thought that I'd like for us to consider in this regard. On the one hand, you had the evil monarchy of God's people, kings that were often very deeply steeped in the worship of Baal, which was a false Canaanite god. And there were a lot of evil rituals associated with that idolatrous religion. And so this evil monarchy that just led God's people further and further away from God would have to suffer. We find other places in the prophets where God threatened to bring that monarchy, maybe I should say, to a pause rather than to an end. Until Shiloh come, until the Messiah would come. One such passage in Ezekiel pours over a repetition of threatening words. I will overturn, overturn, overturn until the rightful owner comes. God saw in Israel's kings, God saw in many of Judah's kings, perpetual corruption and a thirst for sin that they could not satiate. And in his anger and in his wrath, he said, I'm going to bring this monarchy, this corrupt, evil monarchy to an end, or I will pause it. In history, until the rightful owner of that kingly scepter comes along and takes it up and rules in righteousness. And that rightful king is the Messiah, the Son of God. And so on the one hand, we have hints of the judge of Israel, the monarchs of the north, being attacked, being assaulted, and that kingdom being brought to an end. And in its place, centuries later, coming the kingdom of the Messiah. The one who is to be ruler in Israel. The one whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting. This Hebrew phrase that describes Jesus as from everlasting is used in Psalms 90 in verse 2 to describe the eternal nature of God. And so this passage in Micah 5 and verse 2 joins with many other Old Testament passages that affirms the eternal divine nature of God's Son. The Jews of the first century could not abide the idea of God having a son who was divine. And they, with great fervent passion, protested Jesus claiming to be God's son because in their thinking that made him equal with God. And yes, it did. For it is he who thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and was made in the likeness of men. That's how Philippians describes him. And truly, because he is God's son, Jesus was and is equal with God with regard to his form or his substance. He's an eternal divine being. And the Jews of the first century would not accept that, and they rejected Jesus on that account. For when they read the prophets, the Apostle Paul tells us they read with a veil on their hearts. They couldn't see. They were aware of Micah 5 and verse 2. Believe me. At the time of Christ's birth, when Herod the king asked, where's the Messiah to be born? They all answered with one accord in Bethlehem of Judea, because so the prophet says, and they cited this passage. They were aware of Micah 5 and verse 2, but they blinded their eyes and their ears to the part of the passage that said, he is from everlasting. He is an eternal being. So they rejected the deity of the Messiah, God's son. They just looked for an earthly king. And in that, they were mistaken. And in their rejection of the earthly king, or rather Jesus as their king, instead wishing for an earthly king, in their rejection of the Messiah, the king, They put him on trial before Pilate. And so Christ himself, as the judge of Israel, would be struck. He would be smitten. And so we find in this passage not only hints of the monarchy coming to an end, but also a foreshadowing of Israel's best and only real king being smote on the cheek. Isaiah 50 in verse 6, I gave my back to those who struck me and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard. I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. Micah's contemporary, Isaiah, speaks also of Messiah being hit on the cheek and being spat upon and abused in that manner. And we find this prophetic expectation brought to fruition in Matthew 26 and verse 67. Then that they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands. Matthew 27 and 30. Then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. Whatever corrupt judges of Israel, whatever corrupt kings there were that were to be justly brought down, here we find the real judge, the eternal judge, the one who's to be ruler in Israel, being attacked unjustly. For in him was no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. But we understand the reason behind this injustice that's foretold in the prophets. And that reason, my friends, is my sin and yours and theirs. Even the people that hit him on the head with a stick. Even the people that slapped his face. Even the people that pulled his beard. Even the ones who spit in the face of the Son of God. And the ones in Micah's time who bowed the knee to Baal. The ones who burned their children in the fire in honor of the pagan gods. The ones who participated in the perverse rituals of these pagan faiths that drew Israel further and further from their God. Jesus died for all of these. So that the people to whom Micah and Isaiah preached that call to repent and turn to God, so that those people could receive forgiveness of their sins, and in turn you and I could receive forgiveness of our sins. And even the people who put him on the cross. For thus Jesus prayed, as they nailed him there, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Matthew chapter 2, verse 4 through 6, this is the citation I mentioned earlier, where the scribes and the lawyers, the people together, he demanded of them where Christ should be born. And they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou Bethlehem in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. So they understood that Micah 5 and verse 2 was about the Messiah being their king. Continuing now in our reading from those first four verses of Micah 5, we resume at verse 3. Therefore he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth. Then the remnant of his brethren shall return to the children of Israel, and he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall abide, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. I mentioned that idea earlier of the corrupt monarchy of Israel being overturned, being paused, the kings being deposed and placed by foreign rulers or local governors, until such time that the scepter's rightful owner came, the Messiah. I mentioned that, and see, we have here the same idea. He will give them up until this woman gives birth. I wonder what woman that is. Well, in verse 2, a baby's going to be born in Bethlehem. I reckon that's the mother who gave birth, don't you? Yes, in Micah 5 and verse 3, we have a foretelling of Mary, who is in labor giving birth. That monarchy of Israel would come to an end until the Messiah would come. And then David would not want for someone to rule on his throne. The Son of God, born into the world, into the family line and the royal line of David, the rightful heir to David's throne, ruling forever over the Israel of God. Not just people of Jewish descent, but even Gentiles of all nations who would flow into this kingdom. You might remember from our previous study, he foretold that in Micah chapter 4. He would stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord. And how long would he rule? How vast would be the expanse of his reign? It says he would reign to the ends of the earth. And what else would happen? At this time, when that woman gave birth, he would cause to return the children of Israel. He would gather the remnant back. You know, there was no great physical gathering of physical Israelites from scattered around the Roman Empire at the time of Christ's birth. We don't read of any such thing. But we do read in the New Testament of a remnant, a faithful remnant of Israel being gathered into the Messiah's spiritual kingdom. You can read about that in Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11. In fact, Isaiah has a passage where he talks about this remnant in Isaiah chapter 11, and you'll find that passage quoted in that section of Romans that I just cited, where he says, even now, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. At that time, in the first century, there were Jews who would hear the gospel preached and come to understand that the Messiah was not a mere physical king, but a spiritual king with a spiritual kingdom, the eternal Son of God, who had to die for the sins of the world, who was willing in that death for the sins of the world. And this is the one who would gather these believing Israelites into his spiritual kingdom, the church, to join the Gentiles who would also hear the gospel preached and be obedient. That word being mixed with faith would profit them well, as Hebrews teaches us. And they also would become citizens in the Israel of God, what Hebrews chapter 12 calls the Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem. What Galatians chapter 6 calls the Israel of God. What Romans 3 reminds us, it's not a Jew that's one outwardly, but one that is a Jew inwardly. Children of Abraham. All of us are children of Abraham today in the Israel of God. We're all a part of that number that's been gathered into the kingdom that lasts to the very ends of the earth. Vast is the expanse of Messiah's reign. But what about those who were outside of the realm of believers? There's judgment to come. He said, the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles. Wait, I thought they were going to be gathered. They are. They're going to be gathered, and yet they're going to be scattered among the Gentiles. How does that work? Because their gathering is not a physical return to the physical nation of Israel. This is language that symbolically describes their spiritual gathering into the family of God, though they were physically scattered throughout the Roman Empire from one end to the other, and even beyond. The remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of the sheep, who, if he passes through, both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. Your hand shall be lifted against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. Those who would make themselves enemies of God's people would be cut off from his saving mercy. Those who rejected this message of the Messiah that would begin to be spread among the Gentiles by those faithful Jews who were dispersed in their midst, those who rejected that gospel would be cut off, just as would unbelieving Israel. The message would become clear by the first century. You must embrace the Messiah and serve and follow and obey him, or reject him at your own peril. Micah 5 and 15 adds, I will execute vengeance in anger and fury on the nations that have not heard. Woe be to any Jew or Gentile that rejects God's Son. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. So said Jesus himself in John 12 and verse 48. We move into chapter 6 now. Why? Why all this judgment? Why is God punishing his people and casting away so many of them and leaving only the remnant who would accept the Christ and be a part of the new kingdom? Why? O my people, what have I done to you? And how have I wearied you? Testify against me, for I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I redeemed you from the house of bondage. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from the Acacia grove to Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of the Lord. God calls to mind pivotal moments in Israel's history. They were in captivity. They were in severe slavery in the land of Egypt. And God rescued them out. With a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, he saved them. And he's saying, I've done all this for you. What have I done that's made you turn your back on me? Fair question. Our Father asks, not just of Israel, but of us all when we fail him. He calls to mind another pivotal moment. When they were traveling in the wilderness and they would come and take the land, and along comes Balak, an enemy king, wanting them to be consumed. And Balak had asked of Balaam the prophet that he would curse Israel so that Balaam could, so that Balak could defeat Israel, and God would not allow it, and so Balaam would not do it. This we find in Numbers 22, verse 5 and 6, also verse 18. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people. This is Balak asking of Balaam that he would curse Israel. For they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, that I might drive them out of the land. For I wot that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. And Balaam's answer in verse 18. Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, if Balak would give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. Balak hungrily, repeatedly sought Balaam's cursing of Israel. And Balaam wouldn't do it because every time he asked God, can I do this? God said, no, don't. And so God calls this story to mind as further evidence. I've delivered you. I've been good to you. I've helped you. I've nurtured you. I've kept you alive. What have I done that's given you just reason to turn your back on me? What indeed? So what do they have to do? What did Israel have to do to make it right? What do we have to do to be right before God? Micah the prophet asked for us this question, providing the opportunity for him to give God's answer. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God? Micah gives the same answer that prophets of God and men of God have been reverberating throughout the centuries of man's history. You can butcher animal after animal until rivers of blood flow from the altar. And that will not take the place or be better than a heart that is humbly submitted to God. That's what God has always really wanted. And that's what he still wants today. It reminds us of what Samuel said to King Saul in 1 Samuel 15 and verse 22. Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. It's better to just listen to God and do what God has said. But their sin, they continued. They would not give God the service that he demanded. And so he said, for the statutes of Omri are kept, all the works of Ahab's house are done, and you walk in their counsels, that I may make you a desolation and your inhabitants a hissing. Therefore you shall bear the reproach of my people. I believe Omri is the king of the north who bought a parcel of land and built it into a capital city that came to be known as Samaria, the seat of that wicked kingdom that so often so deeply rebelled against their God who had loved them so. And so he says, you people are keeping the statutes of Omri. You're following after this idolatrous king. And the works of Ahab's house, just another king in Israel's history that was so wicked. And so you see, God is telling him, the reason this is all happening is because instead of doing mercy and justice and walking humbly with your God, you're following these pagan ways, which let them cheat their neighbor and rob the widows and be crooked and take bribes. And, you know, no wonder they wanted to worship those pagan gods. I mean, isn't there a little bit of that in an awful lot of folks? I want to redefine my religion to fit what I want to do rather than letting God define what I should be. Continuing into chapter 7, Micah pours out his grief in words so sad. The faithful man has perished from the earth. and there is no one upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. Every man hunts his brother with a net, that they may successfully do evil with both hands. The prince asks for gifts. The judge seeks a bribe. The great man utters his evil desire. So they scheme together. The Micah the prophet sadly depicts God's people joining with the rest of humanity and being a seething cauldron of evil and perpetual sin. He further warns in verse 5, do not trust in a friend. Do not put your confidence in a companion. Guard the doors of your mouth from her who lies in your bosom. It's getting so wicked you can't trust anybody. You ever felt that way about society today? You ever get the feeling it's just getting more wicked than it's ever been and it's just out of control and there's nothing new under the sun? Reread Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. Mankind and even God's people have always gone through these cycles where things get pretty dark. And I'll tell you, in Micah's day, he saw things as being pretty dark. There's not a good man left. I wish I could tell you it didn't get any worse. But it did. If you find that hard to believe, just read the book of Jeremiah. And you'll find out how much worse it got. In spite of all this, God was perched on His throne in heaven, ready to forgive. Please consider Micah 7, verse 18 through 20. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity and passing over the transgression of the remnant of His heritage? He does not retain His anger forever because He delights in mercy. He will again have compassion on us. He will subdue our iniquities. You will cast our sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and mercy to Abraham, which you have sworn to our fathers from days of old. God had promised Abraham and your seed would all families of the earth be blessed, not just Israel, not just Abraham's physical offspring, but as we're taught in the New Testament, they that be of the faith of Abraham. Even these are counted as his seed. And in that, Abraham becomes the father of many nations. For the gospel scheme that was promised to Abraham with those precious words, in you all families of the earth will be blessed, that same gospel scheme was not just limited to rebellious Israel. It was not just limited to the wicked house of Judah and those who followed her evil kings. But it was a spread out to all the ends of the earth, just as we've read of Messiah's rule tonight. It was to be a good news herald that would go out to all people of all nations, so that all nations could flow into God's kingdom, not just those born in the family of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but those who would spiritually be reborn into the family of God's own Son. And so God was perched in heaven, on the ready, eager to forgive any who would turn and walk humbly with his God. For through the unfurling of his eternal scheme would come a day when the judge of Israel would be struck and put to death for the sins of all mankind. And that blood would be our atoning blood, to fulfill this promise made to Abraham so long ago. A promise echoed in Micah's own sentiment. Who is a God like you, so ready to forgive? Not whimsical, not turning on a dime, not having pointless fits of fury where he needlessly punished his subjects for no real reason, but a real, just, and loving God who wants nothing more than to reach out to his people and those outside his family and anyone, even in extreme rebellion against his will, and gather them back as a faithful remnant into his son's family. God thus reaches to you tonight. We're reminded of a scripture we've used for our closing in every study of the prophets, Acts 13 and 27. They that dwell at Jerusalem and their rulers, because they knew him not, nor yet the voices of the prophets which are read every Sabbath day, they have fulfilled them in condemning him. We read here of that which we spoke a little earlier in our study. There were those who read those prophets constantly, but they didn't get the full message. And in failing to grasp that message, they wound up fulfilling the sad part of the story where God's Son would die for the sins of the world. Though they were well acquainted with the words, they did not know the meaning. And that frames for you and I a stern admonition that we might acquaint ourselves more, not just with the words of the prophets, but with their voice, with their collective meaning, with the lessons that they teach us. And tonight we've learned the lesson that God is on the ready to forgive those who will just walk humbly with him. And I want to extend that invitation to you right now, if you're not a Christian, to come and begin to walk humbly with your God by obeying the gospel of Jesus Christ and being baptized into his family. If we can assist you in that, we'd love to do so. If you're a Christian and you need the prayers of the church, we'd love to help you in that way. If we can help you in either way, please come, have a seat on the front pew while we stand and sing.